Okay, Proverbs 11. Let's go through the first five verses fairly quickly, just reminding ourselves of what we studied a couple weeks ago. Beginning there in verse 1, dishonest scales are an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is His delight. First of all, what is an abomination? If something is an abomination to God, what is it?
Disgusting.
Yeah, He hates it. It disgusts Him. It's just something that when He sees it, it makes Him sick. So dishonest scales make the Lord sick. So let's talk about what those are. That would refer to a rigged system of measurement designed to cheat somebody else. It would be scales set up to, in a transaction, weigh something, and there would be a standard that should be right. So the weight of the item should be measured against the standard. But if the scales are dishonest, what is the purpose of that? Yeah, you're ripping them off. That is exactly the whole point behind it. And the writer of Proverbs, Solomon, here says God hates it. He hates someone who would cheat somebody else out of something like that. It really deals with the issue of honesty and integrity. Can we be righteous without honesty and integrity?
No.
You just cannot. Those two things do not go together. Righteousness cannot exist without honesty and integrity. Certainly cheating. And this really, if you get down to it, this is lying. This is a form of lying. It's a form of deceitfulness. And we've read back in Proverbs 6 how God feels about lying. It's an abomination to Him as well. So certainly just a continuation of that idea. Look in verse 2. When pride comes, then comes shame. But with the humble is wisdom. Arrogance is often accompanied by shame. Why might that be? Why might shame come from pride or arrogance?
Because pride, we're looking at ourselves, but God looks at us and He can see further down the road, and further down the road we'd probably be ashamed that we were proud at some point.
Well, yeah. Hopefully we will. Hopefully we will come to have shame of previous pride.
Giving glory to yourself instead of God. I did this. It's all me, you know, and that's just not how it is.
Well, Nebuchadnezzar, I mean, we've looked at that example before that we saw with him staring out there, standing atop his palace, looking at all of these things. Look at what I did. And certainly God immediately punished him to show him and to remind him that you didn't do this by yourself. I'm the one who gave you this. John's point, very, very good there. Thought I saw another hand. Liz.
Mine has, and Linda's has a different word. Mine, with pride comes disgrace, and hers has, with pride comes dishonor. So that might make it a little bit easier to understand that, you know, a person, when they are prideful, you know, it is dishonor to them because other people see that.
It is. Great. All right. Show of hands, who likes an arrogant person? Who likes to be around them all the time and just spend the whole week with them? No. It is shameful. You get tired of me, and you can't tell them anything. There's a certain amount of shame that comes with that as well. On the opposite of that, the second part of the verse, with the humble there is wisdom. Now, who wants to be around humble people? Anybody like being around them? Absolutely. Yeah, that's encouraging. And that's something that we enjoy being around. If we're not humble, will we obey the gospel?
No.
Because repentance is going to require humility. I'm going to have to admit, I was wrong. I sinned against God. I did this. I put the Savior on the cross. And if I'm not willing to do that, if I don't have the humility to do that, I'll never obey. And it's just something that, as Christians, it'll continue to be in our lives. Even after we obey the gospel, if we're not humble, we won't grow. We won't grow. If we ever get to the point where we think we know everything, the growth will stop right there. So it's something that needs to be with us always. Now, 3 and 4, let's look at those together. Again, the idea of integrity. The integrity of the upright will guide them, but the perversity of the unfaithful will destroy them. Riches do not profit in the day of wrath, but righteousness delivers from death. The integrity of the upright will guide them. How so?
They're going to follow the path of righteousness instead of the way of the world. So if they're integrity guiding them in the Word of God, that's going to be the right way to go.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And then for the wicked, it's the opposite. The perversity of the unfaithful will destroy them. They're following the world's path. It always leads to destruction. Now, it may have some bright spots. It may seem like I'm very successful right now. But without God, let's take it to the end. What about when judgment day comes? What we were talking about balances earlier. What can I put on the other side of the balance to offset God's wrath? What in this world can even those scales?
Nothing.
Nothing. The blood of Christ is the only thing that can take care of that wrath, and I can't put that there or put anything worth that myself. It's going to have to be His sacrifice. So,
He even tells us that in the very next verse, that riches, He says, do not profit in the day of wrath. Yeah. So the day of judgment, it's not going to be worth anything.
Yeah.
No matter how much money you have.
Yeah, and he makes the comparison. Riches, those physical things, do not profit, but righteousness delivers. So again, it goes back to spiritual over the physical. We've seen that a great deal in this section. Good. Any other comments on those so far? Bob.
Back to number one.
Sure.
I say a false balance. Balance don't really always have to be weight. It could be something different. I knew a man, and I don't want to falsely accuse him because he never done. I never caught him doing it. He had a grocery store, and I heard that he would set a can or canned goods or something on the counter, and everybody come along, he would ring that up along with that grocery. And if they caught him, he would say, "Oh, I made a mistake." So say he sold that canned good over and over and over. But if he done that, he was wrong.
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah, 50 cents for every person, every day, every time. Yeah, it.
But I think if you put all the categories of the cheating under that same thing.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles, we would go to the farmers market. They would have all this beautiful vegetables and oranges and apples across the counter there. And then when you bought something, say you want a couple pounds, they go underneath and get it. When you get home, you got a half a bag of rotten apples and oranges. They did that a couple of times, And there's nothing you can do about it then. You get home, you can't go take it back and say, if you did this, they're going to deny it.
Wow. And let's go back with taking that idea, it's mentioned with pride brings shame, but that deceitfulness, doesn't deceitfulness bring shame too? Because people find out. I guarantee you, Roy didn't keep shopping there for the next 20 years, right? And if anybody asked him, he would have told him, "I wouldn't go there." So that kind of behavior leads to shame too, even in this life, it does. Good. Okay, well, verse 5, let's pick up. And let's read 5 and 6 together, and this will be sort of a new section for us. The righteousness of the blameless will direct his way aright, but the wicked will fall by his own wickedness. The righteousness of the upright will deliver them, but the unfaithful will be caught by their own lust. The wicked get caught up in their own snares, is the idea there. Their own wickedness ends up being a trap to them. The very desires, the way the New King James words it is, lust. Those are the very things that end up entangling them and getting them into trouble. And it brings trouble upon trouble on them. Any thoughts on those two? Okay, 7 and 8. When a wicked man dies, his expectation will perish, and the hope of the unjust perishes. The righteous is delivered from trouble, and it comes to the wicked instead. Why does the expectation of the wicked perish when he dies?
Because his expectations are based on everything in the world. So that's all gone once we leave the world.
Where are his hopes and his dreams? If he's wicked, is he working on a home in heaven? No, so all of his thoughts and dreams are here. And when he dies, where's his stuff? It's still here, and he can't take it with him. So all of these things that he's put his effort in, and he's put all of this time and all of this dedication, and he has nothing, nothing in eternity to show for it. It's a pitiful situation, but how many people does that describe? The vast majority focus and strive for this life and these things, physical things that they can, tangible things they can touch. And then you have sort of the opposite side. The righteous is delivered from trouble, but it comes upon the wicked instead. Whereas God protects the righteous and delivers them, ultimately, when death comes, what happens to the troubles of the righteous?
They're gone.
They can stay here. What happens to the soul of the righteous? Yeah, eternity. And it's reward and it's peace and it's joy in the presence of the Lord. Those troubles stay here. They don't follow the righteous. The troubles stay here with the wicked. So the wicked just can't seem to get away from the problems. John.
And God says vengeance is his. He might be dishing some extra back out to him for whatever happened to that righteous person.
You know, he certainly knows what they've done. They're not going to escape his judgment. And sometimes for us, we look and we see those doing wicked things, and it seems like, you know, they're not even getting punished. But they may be, and we just don't even realize it. We don't even see it. Is it punishment if you have no friends and nobody who trusts you in this life? Even if you don't realize it, that is a form of, that's an awful, awful way to live. So they're probably getting punished now. I may just not see it. They are certainly, when judgment comes, they're certainly going to answer for things then. So again, John's point is a good one to bring out. God doesn't miss this. When we look out and we see, well, why is this happening? And why does he doesn't miss it. He knows. And he may be using it for some reason that I can't see. But vengeance is his. It will be repaid. And he will certainly pass judgment when he's ready for that. Good. Really good. Matthew, yeah.
Yeah, I know we're talking about the wicked, but in the same sense, we should take encouragement that, you know, as hard as we try, even though others may not see it because it's being overshadowed by somebody who's taking credit for something or doing something, nonetheless, it shouldn't discourage us from doing what's right, because God's going to see that too. If he sees the wicked, he's going to see the just as well in their actions.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it kind of reminds us of the scene where you've got the Pharisee praying, and he goes out on the corner and he's just making all this noise and making sure that everybody sees him. And it says he prayed with himself. And I take that to mean he's the only one who hears him, because God's not paying attention to that prayer. But then you got the publican who humbles himself and he understands that he's a sinner. And that man went home justified. God hears that. So even if nobody else knows, God certainly does. So good. That's sort of a flip side to it. It's a good point to bring out. Very good. Bobby, I think you had a hand up too.
I was thinking about the rich man in Luke chapter 12, verse 16, where he blessed him, his ground brought forth plenty, and he was expecting to live for many days, but God called him a fool and said, this night his soul is required, and he wasn't ready for it.
Right. Let's look at 9 and 12 and 13. We'll come back to 10 and 11. Verse 9, the hypocrite with his mouth destroys his neighbor, but through knowledge the righteous will be delivered. Verse 11, by the blessing of the upright the city is exalted, but it is overthrown by the mouth of the wicked. He who is devoid of wisdom despises his neighbor, but a man of understanding holds his peace. I think all three of these are talking about our dealings with our neighbor and the idea that love your neighbor as yourself and reap the blessings from it. Mistreat your neighbor and reap the consequences. Again, it's another thing that we've seen here when Solomon writes. We see it in the New Testament a lot too. I think of Galatians, that we do reap what we sow. It does come around and it does come back to haunt us. Verse 9 especially, the way a person uses their mouth about another, the way they talk about someone, and certainly the idea of a hypocrite there, it can bring good. Can you use your mouth for good? Yeah, certainly you can. That tongue can be used. How is the gospel taught? especially by the apostles.
They're talking.
They spoke it. They wrote it too, obviously so. But the tongue was used for much good. But then there's the flip side, especially when the hypocrite gets involved, who says one thing and does another. It can bring down and it can destroy and cause all kinds of problems to those around him. What do the wise do in verse 12? How do they respond? Or how do they act?
They hold their peace.
They know when to keep quiet. And there are some times that you... And our nation as a whole has trouble with this. There are some times where the appropriate answer is just be quiet. You don't have to comment on every single thing. And that is one. There are wonderful blessings that come through the internet. But the internet has also caused people to think that, you know what? I need to comment on everything that everybody has ever said this whole week. You need my opinion. I need to write a blog and comment on every news. I don't need to say everything about everything. There are some things where I can just be quiet and let it go. It seems that we have more and more trouble with that. Now, are there times to speak? Are there times when the righteous must speak? Yeah, absolutely. There are. When sin is being exalted, is that a time for the righteous to speak? It's time to speak truth. It is. You don't have to be arrogant. You don't have to be like the Pharisee and say, look at me, look at what I have to say. But you can stand for truth and you can speak it and do it, as we talked earlier in the first few verses, with humility and meekness. But stand up for truth. So certainly not saying be quiet all the time. But again, the wise know when to hold their tongues, hold their peace, as the New King James words it here. Thought I saw, yeah, Bob, go ahead.
I'm pretty sure Herod didn't want John to tell him what he was doing wrong. John told him anyway. He lost his head, but still, he allowed Herod the opportunity to know he was doing wrong before he died.
You think John knew that this was probably going to end badly when he said it?
Oh yeah,
I do too. you're in the throne of a king, the throne room of a king, and you tell him this. You know, what authority that did that king have physically? Life and death. He certainly had John's life within his hands. So John knew, and he said it anyway, because he had integrity, and because of honesty, and because of righteousness. Three things that we've talked about this morning already. John had all of those things, and he said it because it was true. And hardship came on him. Immediately there, what was the ultimate result for John? Peace with his Lord. Yeah, reward. So, again, we got that example there. Sasha, I think you had.
I was just going to say, not necessarily with your mouth, but the idea of hypocrisy destroying your neighbor. You know, the example you give can win someone to the Lord or drive them away from the Lord. And with hypocrisy, that's one of those words that people use all the time. And it's a problem. It's definitely a problem. But people will say, I'm not going to worship because that congregation is full of hypocrites. But they won't use that same logic with their job or the grocery store or a restaurant, because I guarantee I've worked for them. There are hypocrites everywhere. But people only use that logic when it comes to the Lord. And it's another way that we can destroy our neighbor. It's a problem that needs to be fixed, but it's not an excuse.
Yeah, great. If there are hypocrites in a local congregation, and there may very well be, what does that have to do with Jesus giving his life for me? What does that have to do with my responsibility to him and my allegiance to him? If you're a hypocrite, does that change my allegiance to him one bit? If I'm a hypocrite, does that change your responsibilities to him one bit? No. And that's one of those things where the innocent gets punished. Right? I'm not going to go worship today because he's a hypocrite. What did Jesus do wrong in this scenario? And yet who suffers? I suffer, and my brethren suffer because they're discouraged, and Jesus suffers. You think that hurts him? when people that he's bought back with his blood say, I'm not going to worship you today because I'm mad at you, think it hurts him? Sure it does. He died for these people. So it's one of those cases we get mad and we end up punishing the innocent. The one who truly has done no wrong ends up having to deal with it. So again, good point. Very good.
You know, when Jesus died, we were all hypocrites. It wasn't just a few. Everybody was a hypocrite. And he still died for us. So there may be a few hypocrites in the congregation, but that doesn't mean anything as far as your salvation is concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. Linda?
I always tell people when they say that to me, at least they're sitting on the pew and something may be said that changes their life. Now what's your excuse?
They may hear something that leads them to repentance. If I'm not listening to the word taught, what's the chances that my heart's going to be pricked? That's a good point. Really good point. You think there are any hypocrites in the first century church? Think anybody who read Paul's letters at Ephesus or Colossae, you think any of them may have been a hypocrite? Probably a good chance that some of them were. But what about the rest? Did that change the responsibility of the faithful in any way? No, it didn't. Bob?
How about Ananias and Sapphira?
Yeah.
They said they gave all the money that they got for the land that they sold, but they held some of it back.
Right, which... we can even go back to verse 1. I mean, in a sense, isn't that the same idea as dishonest scales? I mean, saying one thing, but actually the truth is something else. I read the wrong verse. I wanted to put 13 with this, so let's look at that. A talebearer reveals secrets, but he who is of a faithful spirit conceals a matter. A talebearer is untrustworthy, right? You cannot believe anything that he says. My dad was... toward the end of his career, when he was in the Navy, he had secret clearance and top secret clearance. And I was 11 years old. That was the most fascinating thing in my world, that he had clearance to those two things. And so I asked him, I was like, can you just tell me what one of the secrets is? I won't tell anybody. You know, except my friends. Monday, as soon as I find out, I'll tell them all. But can you just tell me? He said, no, what part of secret do you not understand, boy? But then I didn't forget. He wouldn't tell me then. When he retired, which was, you know, a couple years later, I'm like, all right, Dad, you don't work for the government anymore, right? Can you tell me now? Those things probably... No, I can't tell you. They were secrets. And it stuck with me. And you know, he was trustworthy. Even when he was no longer affiliated with that group, he was faithful to what had been entrusted to him. And it sticks with me. There are things that will be told to you and me by our brethren that we need to keep quiet. There are some things that they come to us with trust because they want advice, or they may just need to let something out and they need somebody to talk to. I don't need to go tell everybody about it. Now, I understand that things that involve sin with others and things like that that may have a public effect, okay, there may be instances like that. But when somebody comes to you in trust, they need to know that you're trustworthy. And you're not going to become a talebearer and just go run out and let me email everybody. You know, this is a quality that we need to possess. We need to be trustworthy. And it goes back to sometimes you just need to be quiet. Just hold your peace. A man of understanding does that. Verse 12. Okay. Any other thoughts on those ideas? Let's go back to 10 and 11. Just the idea of good leadership and how it brings peace and prosperity. When it goes well with the righteous, the city rejoices. And when the wicked perish, there's jubilation. By the blessing of the upright, the city is exalted, but it is overthrown by the mouth of the wicked. A city is exalted and rejoices when it has righteous leadership. Righteous leaders, we've been talking about being trustworthy, they can be trusted. They give wise counsel. Righteous leaders make godly decisions. Just to think of a few, thinking in Judah, Jehoshaphat, Hezekiah, Josiah. Those were some of the good kings during Judah's days. What was the state of Judah when those men ruled? was blessed, yeah. And when war came against them, God helped them. In the days of Hezekiah, certainly war came against them. Sennacherib of the Assyrians came against them. But God helped them. God defeated that problem because the people were being led righteously in a righteous manner. And it ends up blessing the whole nation. When it goes well with the righteous, the whole city rejoices. And that's one of the things that if I'm righteous in my house, who does it affect? Who does it affect? Yeah. Everybody. Does it help Sasha if I'm righteous? What about Anaya and Aaron? Yeah, it helps everybody. It helps people who come into the house. It blesses everyone. What if I'm not? Who does it affect? It's the same thing in reverse. Look,
if you look about the world and the governments and the natural resources of the country, where what I've observed is where there's corrupt political governments, you know, leaders, doesn't matter how much natural resources they have, the general populace of the country is in poverty. Hmm. But yet, and what's different, what I've seen and what's different in the U.S. used to be, it's changing, unfortunately. Used to be, yeah, there were a few corrupt people here and there, but generally, everybody had the majority of the leaders had some, honesty and some trustworthiness and some devotion to the country. Now, I see it changing, but that was opposite of some place like the Philippines where everybody was okay. Or in Mexico, who has vast resources, but yet they all want to come here. And they have, you know, they have as much oil as we do. They have vast oil reserves. Silver, you know, they have a country that can grow all kinds of agricultural products. Mm-hmm. But because of corruption, they can't, you know, they cannot even come close to what we have. But they should. If they were not corrupt from the top down.
Yeah. Okay. Now let's talk about that idea. When the leadership is ungodly, what effect does it have? We talked about it in the house. What effect does it have on the nation?
It does,
and one excuse that I'll give an example. This is certainly not on a national level. You remember, and it may still happen. I don't know. When DirecTV first came out, there were people, you know, the little cards that make a DirecTV unit function where it can show what channels you can get and all that. There were people who were taking cards and they were stealing DirecTV. They would, you know, get the cards to do whatever they wanted, and it would allow you access without paying to get all of the stuff. And I knew someone who did it, and he tried to. Yeah, my dad again. He tried to get my dad to do it. And he said, "That's stealing. You can't do that. That's wrong." And the guy's excuse was, "I know cops who do this. They're police officers who do this. How can you say it's wrong?" So you got police officers who are stealing DirecTV. What? How does that justify it for everyone else? But the idea, when leadership or those in authority show corruption and make it seem okay, what effect does it have on people around them? They start to think it's okay too. Now, certainly we got to make individual decisions, but it can create a society that grows up thinking unrighteousness is okay because look at what I can get out of it. So it does trickle down in the house, in the church, certainly in the nation as well. Bob?
When God said, "Go to Jerusalem and worship," Jeroboam set up two golden calves, one in Dan, one in Bethel, and told people it was too hard for them, too much for them to go to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And they started going to Dan and Bethel, and it became sin to them.
Yeah.
Also, sin of Jeroboam.
But the king told me to do it.
Still wrong.
The king said it was okay. What had God told them to do?
Go to Jerusalem.
But the cop said it was okay. What is right and wrong? Tell me. It's stealing. So So yeah, it's a great point, Bobby. Really, really good. John?
Yeah. If you're in a position of power or authority, when you set the bar for integrity, you set it for everyone that's on you.
Yeah.
In your family or at work, or if you're a politician, I mean, you set that standard, and you're telling whoever answers to you what's okay and not okay.
Yeah.
And you can set it low, and that's what you're going to get back.
Yes.
You can set it high, and, you know, you can have people always working towards it, or they'll do it. But, you know, you're responsible for more than just your decisions.
That's a good point. I think we underestimate what a good leader can accomplish. And if they set the example of right, there are many who will try to follow it too. They really will. And it would surprise us. And that's one of those things, we get frustrated when we see dishonesty and corruption. And sometimes you kind of just want to throw your hands up and say, you know what, I'm going to move to another country. I'm tired of this. What we need to be doing is what's right, and praying for those in a position of power that something will change their hearts. Because if they change, they can change the minds of others too. It can happen. We've seen it in the history of Judah. We've seen them go from very bad to very good when good leadership came in. It can happen, but we need to do our part. We need to be righteous examples regardless of what anyone else is doing. Good comments.
We can go right back to verse 3 where it says the integrity of the righteous will guide them. Doesn't matter what somebody else say or somebody else do.
That's right.
If you have the righteous integrity, you're going to ignore that. You know, that's your guide. So it doesn't matter what the president say or what politicians say. If it's not in line with what God said, then you don't pay any attention.
Acts 4 and 5 in a nutshell, right? The apostles in trouble for preaching Jesus. Don't preach his name anymore. And what do? They preach Jesus. Why?
Because that was the right thing.
Because he had more authority. He had a higher authority than the ones telling them to stop preaching. So they follow God instead of men. Good point, Lord. Okay, let's pick up a few more. Let's go with 14 and 15. Similar idea. Where there is no counsel, the people fall. But in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. He who is surety for a stranger will suffer, but one who hates being surety is secure. Two different ideas there, actually. I should have just taken them one at a time. But 14, where there is no wise counsel, the people will fall. Good leadership is essential. We've talked about that. If you turn 1 Timothy 2, let's look at something quickly. Just a reminder. There's some who like politics and enjoy politics. I don't. I just, it gives me a headache. I don't like it. And so the temptation for me is just to sort of wash my hands and walk away. I can't do that because I have a responsibility as a citizen according to God here. 1 Timothy 2, I look at verses 1 and 2. Therefore I exhort, first of all, that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence, for this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior. What's my responsibility? Supplications and prayers and intercessions and giving of thanks be made, particularly for those kings and all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet, peaceable life. I like being able to come here on Sunday mornings and worship without fear that there's a good chance somebody's going to walk in and start shooting us. I like that. You know, that's nice. If I want that to continue happening, I need to intercede. I need to ask for God's blessings to help for those things. Now, again, going back to the points that have been made, whatever is taught, we have a responsibility to the Lord. Do what is right. Do what He's commanded. But so far as it doesn't violate any of His teachings, we should be good citizens of this country too. We should be. The country will be better if we are. So, one thing to keep in mind for us. 15, we've talked about this idea before, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. He who is surety, this is, again, beware being entangled in the financial engagements of others. Be careful what you sign, what you co-sign on, because you can... The wise do not just up and sign for anybody who asks them to co-sign. They understand that their financial situation can be greatly affected by someone else. So be careful what you involve yourselves in. Consider your own family and consequences before becoming surety for another. Okay, 16 is an idea I'd really like us to maybe finish on and talk. It's just a good point to be made. A gracious woman retains honor, but ruthless men retain riches. A gracious woman. She's kind-hearted. She's respected. She's treated honorably. Do you know any women like that? You know any honorable women? They may not have a lot materially. They may not have a whole lot physically, but they are gracious with whatever it is that they do have. How do people feel about a woman like that?
Good.
They love them, especially Christians. Let's talk about brethren. Sisters in Christ who may not be super wealthy, but they are gracious. They give of what they have. They try to take care of others. They don't bring attention to themselves to do it, but they're always looking to meet needs. What does that do for the congregation? When you have women doing those things without anybody saying anything, looking to meet needs, going and visiting, cooking and sewing or whatever they have to do, just going and talking, spending time with sisters and encouraging others, what effect does it have? Duke, go ahead.
It makes the congregation better. It's by their example, their teaching. They said, you know, I think of the passage, old women teach younger ones.
Yeah.
And they do that by example and by actions as well. You know, and of course, scripture. But, you know, they have a tendency to bring out and guide others to bring out the best in people and the best in the congregation as well. You have to have that for the congregation to be a good congregation. To do what we should do.
Absolutely. Liz?
It brings honor to the congregation. It's like the woman in Proverbs 31. She brings honor to her husband. It's by the things that she is doing. A gracious woman is an honor.
Think of just women that I've known, and I'm thankful for women I came into contact with after obeying the gospel just because of the example they set. And think of two in particular. One, she didn't have a whole lot. She's still alive. She doesn't have a whole lot physically. But she would save up, and then just one Sunday, she would tell all of the young people, you know, those in the late teens and in their 20s, to follow her. And she would take them and feed all of them, either at her house or she'd take them all out. You know, you take a group of 12, 20-somethings to Golden Corral. I mean, that's quite... She saved up so she could do it. Why did she do it?
Be an example for one thing.
She loved them, and she wanted to show them and encourage them. And I would thank her for it and say, you know, you don't have to do this. She would always say, I want you to be together. Y'all need to be together. Y'all need to spend this time together and talk and just be able to share a meal together. Is there something special about sitting around a table with brethren sharing a meal? Yeah, it is. And she understood that and wanted us to see that. That's a good foundation, especially for me as a brand new Christian, to see someone doing that. And, you know, a lot of times we may think, well, I don't have a whole lot. I can't do that. We can do something. Just spending the time to talk with our brethren and just encourage them in whatever way we can. You don't have to spend money. Just make the effort. Show them and try to build that bond. It's extremely important. Contrasted to that in this verse is a ruthless man. The ruthless man is the exact opposite of everything we just said. He is ruthless. He is cruel. And it says there that he will retain his riches. Well, that's true. If he is cruel and he is conniving and he's underhanded, will he attain some money? Is there a good chance he'll be rich? Yeah, he will. But he will always put himself first. His desires rule. His desires are most important. He has no time for compassion upon anyone else. Now, what effect does that have on those around him? Oh, man. It just destroys relationships. It just rips them apart. He may get riches out of it, but that's about all he'll get in this life. He certainly won't build anyone up. He certainly won't help anybody to serve the Lord. He may serve as a bad example. That may be the only good thing that comes out of watching him. But such a great difference. And again, verse 16, a gracious woman retains honor. There are so many things that certainly we can all do. And it doesn't just apply to women. I think we know that. I mean, a gracious man can attain honor as well. I like the fact that it brings it up and applies it to godly women here, because there are so many things. When it was after Sasha graduated, and she was spending some time at home, and she was going to ladies' Bible classes, and she was visiting, and you know, she was doing various things like that. And we had something at the bank, and this guy came up to her and said, "So what are you doing? You graduated now. What are you doing?" She's like, "Well, I'm at home right now." And he's like, "Oh, so you're not doing anything?" And I'm like, "Easy, baby." Well, you know, because she's like, because visiting people is nothing, right? I mean, that's worthless, right? And encouraging people and spending time with brethren, what a waste of time. And a lot of people in the world are like that. They don't see the importance of those bonds. And they will make your value only what your profession is. And that's what when they look at you, they're like, "Oh, okay. Well, he's a dentist. That's his value." It's ridiculous. Don't let them do it to you. There is so much more that defines us, especially as Christians. There's so much we can be doing that has nothing to do with where I go to work every day. And there are things that build and make the good for everyone. Go ahead, Bill.
I think that it's intentional the way this is worded, where a gracious woman retains honor, a ruthless man retains riches. It's a contrast, but it puts the woman first. And I've seen it in the home. I've seen it in a congregation. The women actually encourage the men to take their leadership role by doing their proper godly assigned things that they're supposed to do. In other words, when a woman is doing this in the home, she can take, by example and encouragement, a man that's kind of lukewarm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And set him on fire to be the leader of the home spiritually and even in his job. It helps the secular world and, of course, the congregation. But without that, without that, the man's going to struggle. So it might be a subtle thing here, but I think it's a very important one to note that the women have a very great job when they're doing a role to strengthen a congregation and a home.
Yeah, let's put one verse with. I know we've gone over, but this is good to go with it. Chapter 12, verse 4, an excellent wife is the crown of her husband. And we'll talk more about that, Lord willing, next week. And it is absolutely true. Absolutely true. But read the rest of the verse. Read the opposite side. But she who causes shame is like rottenness in his bones. Bill talked about the building up and the strengthening and the equipping of the husband to be what he should be. When it doesn't happen, when it's the opposite, it is absolute chaos. It is an absolute mess. And we'll talk about that more next week. Let's stop there. Thank you guys for the questions. And Lord willing, we will pick up with verse 17 in chapter 11 next week.